Hey, everybody, I'm Chris Mannix from The Vertical, and welcome to The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, where I check in with some of the top players, coaches, and analysts covering the NBA. My guest this week is Tommy Heinsohn, a Basketball Hall of Famer and one of the most fascinating color commentators in the game. I asked Tommy about his relationship with the great Red Auerbach.
I went up to him one time and I said, "Red, do I deserve to be starting on this team?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "Well, look, if that's true, you got to stop all this nonsense about me being responsible for everything that goes wrong."
And how his now 60-year relationship with the Celtics nearly ended in the 1970s when he was fired as the team's coach.
Politics, when things aren't going well, becomes horrendous. And I'm not a political person. You don't want me? See you later. I'll do something else.
All that and more coming up next on The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Well, I have many questions for Tommy Heinsohn, a man with 10 NBA championships, a man that is one of four to be inducted to the Basketball Hall of Fame, a man who should be the first ever inducted as a player, coach, and broadcaster. Well, I want to start with this, Tommy. For years, you called games for CBS in the 1980s, and every time I go by one of those games on NBA TV and see you calling Celtics games, I marvel. How were you able to be the objective broadcaster in those games?
Well, of course, national games are quite different than regional games because regional games, really the audience is the team's real rabid fans. So the national games is take a pick. And what I did on the national games is I would get scouting reports of both ball clubs the week before. And then I would imagine me coaching both teams and exploit the weaknesses of each team. And that was the first time the Laker fans ever found out there were weaknesses on a Lakers team. And the Celtic fans found out there were weaknesses on the Celtic team. So a lot of people missed that point, I got to tell you. And to situation where I actually had a tie made that was half green and half purple, just to show that I was impartial, or try to show.
Do you still have that tie?
I don't know where it is, but I thought I kept it.
Was it hard as someone that has been part of this organization for so long to kind of flip that switch and stay the straight and narrow?
Yeah, I mean, the controversial things happen, you know, and those are the areas that people claim that you're a homer and a whole bit. And doing the national broadcasts, there were, you know, McHale knocking down Rambis and the whole bit, and Ralph Sampson biting, I forget who's fighting down in Houston. That was a national game, and I was forced to find out whether this was proper basketball. But in my playing days, I would have loved it.
60 years being a part of the organization as a player, coach, or broadcast, does it feel like 60 years?
You know, it went by, like everybody will say, when the older they get, it went by quickly. But what happened that kept my interest. You know, I hardly believe how old I am because I have an interest in watching competitive people really max out their skills. And that's the fun to me, watching the people, not whether the Celtics really win or lose, but I get immersed in the personalities and what they bring and how they perfect their personhood playing basketball.
56, you were drafted. You're from Jersey, played at Holy Cross. Did you want to be drafted by the Celtics?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Bob Cousy was there. It was up-tempo basketball. So I was the territorial pick, which no longer exists. So that preceded the regular draft. So I, in essence, was the number one pick. And then Russell Celtics got by virtue of a trade with St. Louis, and they got St. Louis's pick. Mm-hmm.
Do you your early relationship with Red Auerbach, what was that like?
Well, there was a point when I was at Holy Cross, you know, he was making statements about me in the press, and you know, this, that, and he didn't seem at all enthusiastic about me playing. So I went to explore an opportunity in the AAU with the Peoria Caterpillar Company to play AAU ball and also get a job. I majored in economics, and so there was a Holy Cross guy that brought me out there, but I didn't really think I was going to enjoy Peoria. So I came back, and the day I got back, Cousy called me and said, "What are you doing going out to Peoria? But they really want to talk to you." He said, "I'll drive you down to Boston." So he picked me up at Holy Cross, and I didn't really know Cous. You know, he's 6 years older than me, so he was long, you know, was a big star in the NBA already. And I'm a, you know, potential rookie. But that's what happened. I went down and Red, meeting Red, he immediately took the offensive, put you on your heels. And his last comment was to me, "Now look at Holy Cross, you wore that T-shirt under your uniform. You got to take that T-shirt and shove it." Thank you, Red.
So there was a real chance you weren't going to play for the Celtics, that you might go to Peoria?
According to Kuz and Red at that point, they always were going to draft me. So, but it didn't seem like that to mm-hmm. me. Nobody talked to me beforehand or anything else. I had seen the Celtics play in Worcester twice in the preseason games, you know, went in the locker room and all that nonsense. But really never met anybody or talked to anybody.
Every story that I've read about you and Red's relationship was that he was pretty hard on you back in those days.
Well, he didn't yell at Russell because he was a leader. And he had a great relationship with Russell because Russell's college coach belittled him. And he wouldn't yell at Cousy. He wouldn't yell at Bill Sharman because Sharman would get mad and likely would punch him out. I didn't yell at Sam Jones or Casey Jones. And that kind of left me. And he knew after doing it so often that, it didn't bother me. Occasionally, it would rub me because it became at times protracted. And I would I went up to him one time and I said, "Red, do I deserve to be starting on this team?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "Well, look, if that's true, you got to stop all this nonsense about me being responsible for everything that goes wrong." I said, "Because you keep doing that, the rookies are stealing my socks right now." So he said, "I'll take care of that, Tommy." He went into the locker room and he said, "Rookies, don't steal his socks."
So, I mean, what was the worst confrontation that you had with Red? The worst?
I never had a confrontation with Red. Never. Mm. I mean, I ended up broadcasting games with right. Red. He was my color man. We had lots of laughs during the games together. He asked me to be the coach before Russell. So I had we used to go to the movies together. You know, Red would hobnob with everybody. You know, everybody had a relationship with him. But I used to go to movies with him. And I tell people, we'd go to these war movies and we'd end up rooting for different sides.
You mentioned him. He loved Russell. And that relationship in particular was one of the defining ones for the Celtics over the years.
Well, Russell was a great personality. He's one of the guys I admire because of what happened during the course of his career and how he dealt with different things. But he had an itch to be great and to be recognized as a person, not a basketball player. So he wouldn't sign autographs. And no matter who you were, even a teammate. But Russell, Red took that, and he became Russell's John the Baptist. He spread the word while everybody was paying, terrific attention to Cousy, who was the flashy guy. They didn't know enough about basketball in Boston at the time that they could see what Russell was doing. They couldn't praise him properly. And it took Red to kind of stir the waters and make sure that he got recognition. So Russell knew what Red was doing, and they had a fabulous relationship.
You came into the league with Russell same year. What was that relationship like early? Did you get on with him early?
Well, he was still fuming in San Francisco. You know, he played in the Olympics. And prior to going to the Olympics, he lost the most valuable player of California to a guy named Kenny Sears, who he termed a white guy who got it, and that he should have gotten it. He probably should have. Mm-hmm. All right? And here I come, and I start the season. We're 8 games or so in first place by the time he shows up from the Olympics. And I had a great season. So I get an envelope, and I dressed right next to him. And there was an envelope there with my mail, and it had the NBA logo on it. And he said, "What's that for?" I said, "I don't know." So I opened it up, and it was a letter saying, "You have been named the NBA Rookie of the Year. And here's a check for $250. How about that?"
Huge money. Huge money.
And he looked at me, and he said, "You should give me half of that." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because if I'd been here at the beginning of the year, you wouldn't have gotten it." How gracious can you be? But he was looking at things primarily through those lenses. And I reminded him of Kenny Sears. That's what happened. But over the years, we've had a great relationship. You know, I mean, I was part of the committee for a statue. He just goes, there's nobody that impacted the game like he did.
What's $250 to early 20s Tommy Heinsohn in 1957?
Well, I'll tell you, when I got out of Holy Cross, I bought a brand new car for $800. Okay. 2 years later, I bought an 11-room house from a dentist for $18,000. Okay. So way different now. And after 10 years, or after 5 years, they did a survey of my class and how much the earnings were, the average earnings of, and it was something like my class raised $5,000 a year. Mm-hmm. All right, and I was making way more. So I was a happy camper regardless.
Russell had a complicated relationship with Boston, didn't he?
Boston had a complicated relationship with him. Mm-hmm. After we won a championship, the town of Reading honored him at the Reading Country Club. And we all went to this thing. Mm-hmm. And he was so taken by it, he started to cry. And what his remarks were is that, "I want to live in Reading for the rest of my life." And he went to buy another house. And baby, they joined up against him, and all kinds of things going on so that he couldn't buy a house. So those are the type of things that happened to Russell. And then he didn't sign autographs, okay? So that was an easy excuse for the press to go after him. But they didn't realize that when somebody asked him for his autograph, he might take 15 minutes out of his life to explain why he wouldn't sign the autographs. And I'd say to him, "Russ, it'll only take you 10 seconds to sign your name and go on your way." No, he wasn't going to do it. So that's the way he was. And it really had to do with him being recognized as a person. Mm.
What was the at home during games? I mean, was it a supportive crowd for him, like at the arena for Russell?
Like I tell you, they didn't know what the heck he was doing, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he was a big black guy that came in, and he couldn't shoot the ball. And yet everybody's saying how great a player he is. Well, you had to know a lot about the basketball game in order to assess what his worth was. Mm-hmm. And they surely didn't have it. And Cousy had already established himself as the Houdini of the hardwood. So he caught on. He was that main attraction. And that was the interesting thing about Red Auerbach, how he utilized Cousy and his adulation. And when I said Red was Russell's John the Baptist, he spread the word about Russell. So the two of them got along pretty well because they knew they needed each other, and the rest of us fell in line.
Those teams were enormously successful, the most successful ever in the NBA. Was it a close team in the locker room?
Everybody got along great. I mean, we had family parties together. Mm. And back in those days, there were 10 players. Mm. And you had a roommate. Mm. So there were 5 rooms, okay? And one room would get up and go to have breakfast, and you go downstairs, and all of a sudden another room would come down. So 40% of the team might be having breakfast together, mm-hmm. okay? Not now. I mean, they all have single rooms and, you know. So we were thrown in together. Plus, travel wasn't quite as nifty as it is now. And we spent a lot of time playing cards in railroad stations and plane airports, what have you. So, but we always had a ton of fun. Mm-hmm. Everybody on our team was a very competitive person. That's the genius of Red Auerbach as a manager, is seeking out really competitive people.
So you had 5 roommates on the road?
No.
No.
You had one roommate.
One roommate.
But there were 5 rooms.
Oh, 5 rooms. Okay.
Okay, so.
Gotcha.
2 rooms might get together mm-hmm. having breakfast, you know.
Right.
And that doesn't happen now.
No, room service or you're by yourself.
Right.
The debate over the greatest coach of all time is often between Phil and Red. You've played for Red. We're around Red a lot. You've seen Phil up close. I mean, where do you stand on that greatest coach argument?
Well, we're going to find out what Phil really is to the game of basketball with what he does in New York. Because Auerbach was a builder of teams. He put the teams together. And whenever I'm asked that question, I give homage to Phil Jackson. Mm-hmm. Phil Jackson was inserted into teams which had already been developed and were ready to peak. So he took advantage of – he never built a team. This is the first time down with the Knicks that he will have been part of building a team. Red Auerbach did all of that. And the other thing is, how many players of Phil Jackson are now coaching? And, you know, virtually every player coached after he left the Celtics, all right, because and spread his Red's philosophy, all right? Mm. I mean, when I coached the Celtics, he knew that I was going to pick it up and maybe augment what was being done or do it in a way under the current way they played the game, the defenses, what have you. But I always believed in the strategy and the tactics.
When you look at Red as his strengths as coaches, is it strategy? Was that his strength? Was it motivation? I mean, what would you define as his greatest strength?
Well, Red knew some basketball, but everybody attributes him to be, you know, a basketball genius. And he was a management genius. Mm-hmm. What he did was get people to ante up their total personhood for what they were doing. And I call those teams basketball's Casa Nostra, because he made us all believe it was our thing. Mm-hmm. And how he did it was by involving you in decisions from the very beginning of training camp, to 2 minutes left being 10 points down, and you're part of the decision-making on what you're going to do. So all the years we played for him, everybody would have to ante up about his situation on the court at a particular time, assess what you could do, and you would have to do that in front of your teammates. In other words, pledging you would make it work. So you ended up where you had pride of authorship. So everybody felt happy that their creativity could come out, their knowledge of the game. I mean, nowadays, They got six coaches. They call timeout. The coaches go out normally to the free throw line. And instead of the players talking to the coaches, the players are checking out the cheerleaders. So, I mean, their heads are not involved in a game like we were.
Mm-hmm. When did that change? When did you see that coaching kind of evolve to be that form of it is today?
Well, first of all, in order to do that, you have to have some people who really know how to play the game so that you can trust them as the chief manager of the people, and the teammates can trust them. So everybody that I played with had been a winner, and they were all Americans or close to it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it all worked. But Red, he was a terrific. You mentioned about him getting on my case and not this guy's case and the whole bit. He knew how to talk to the people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, whatever negative thing he had to say to Russell or Cousy was always behind the door, okay? Not in front of anybody.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Hi, boys and girls. It's Tony Kornheiser reminding you to subscribe and listen to my daily podcast, where we talk about everything from sports to politics to the impending animal revolution. And remember, you can listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play.
When did you decide you wanted to be a coach?
Well, I had a very promising career in the life insurance business. When I retired as a player, I had been in the life insurance business for 9 years and was very successful at it, to the point where when I retired as a player, the chairman of the board of my insurance company wanted me to get involved in the management end of it, and I ended up being assigned to the Boston agency, and the agency was going to be up for grabs in 3 years because that fellow was retiring in 3 years. So I took all of the management training courses and everything else, and I found out, taking these courses, how smart Red really was. And I started thinking about it. But I did very well as a manager in that business and kind of tripled what they were doing in the agency, plus maintaining pretty much my own sales. So Red had asked me the year he was going to retire if I wanted a coach, and I quite frankly I said, Red, I couldn't handle Russell. I mean, you're the best at handling Russell. I said, why don't you make him the coach? He's so proud, he'd get the most out of himself. Nobody else is going to be able to deal with him like you did. So I took a pass. But then he asked me to do the television. And I got thrown back into the atmosphere of the NBA. And like I said, he became my color guy on the last year and a half of the broadcast. So, and when Russell denigrated Wilt Chamberlain in that playoff when Wilt didn't go back in the game, I knew Russell wasn't coming back. Because he would never say that to give Chamberlain ammunition. So when that happened, I said to Red, if you still want me to coach, I'd be interested. And the reason why is because I wanted to be involved with people that were able to motivate themselves. Instead of, like in insurance, you have to bring them in, recruit them, train them, motivate them. People in basketball have already been self-motivated to the nth degree. And that's the reason I went in, because I still like managing people.
Mm. Did you sell insurance to your old teammates?
Yeah, yeah.
They all buy it? Or?
Well, some of them did.
What was it? Was it strange coaching guys that you had played with I'm sure a few of them were still on the team that you had played with before.
Well, you know, like, I was the whipping boy, okay? So now this is the – picture this. Here's the guy that all the press has ever heard about. It's his fault for this and for that, okay? And here Red Auerbach names him the coach. And they say, oh, well, Red's going to sit there and coach the team. You know, he'll just be the mouthpiece. So I had established my own credibility. And the first year I coached, we had to weed out the type of players that wouldn't fit. We lost Russell and Sam Jones, the offense and the defense, in one summer. Mm. So I came back dedicated to a strong belief in a strategy of up-tempo, the up-tempo game at both ends of the floor, and also the tactics of fast break and pressure defense. And so I try to incorporate that with smaller people. And the smaller the people got, which is what they're doing now, it was easier to win. Believe it or not, people think size is so important in basketball. It's only important 10 feet from the basket. Quickness and speed, 84 feet, you can use quickness and speed, not size. So I incorporated all that into what we did, developed an offense similar to what they're doing now, pulled the big man out of the middle, created opportunities to force all these huge bona fide centers who were scoring this and that and make them go out and bend their knees on the perimeter and play defense. So we played a different game. They didn't know what to do with us. Mm-hmm.
You pick up a couple of championships as a coach. Then you get fired in 78. Who fired you? Was it Red? Was it the owner?
The owner was, I call him Irv the Swerve. Irv Levin, his name was, you know. And the year before, they let Paul Silas go, right? And he had called me up, Irv, you know, and he said, we got... Silas and we can get Sidney Wicks. So I said, Irv, let me tell you this. You haven't seen fit to make me privy to the money end of this business. I said, but Silas might be the second most important player on this team. So I don't know what it takes to get him, but that's what you ought to be thinking about. And they let him get away. Mm-hmm. And Cowens got upset. He took a flyer on me. We got Sidney Wicks and Curtis Rowe. Curtis Rowe was in the beginnings of dealing with dope. Sidney Wicks played pretty well for me. He wasn't as great a player as everybody thought he was because he had bad hands, and we'd throw him long passes, and he couldn't catch them. But all of a sudden, my last season – with Irv, and they're talking to me about I didn't coach well the year before against Philadelphia because I didn't play, or I did play the bench and this and that and the whole bit, you know. And we had no third guard, you know what I mean, that we could win with. So I was trying to patch things, and the man didn't understand. You know, he was in a movie business, so... What did he know? And Red, he was after Red too. Mm-hmm. So it was not a great atmosphere to be around him. I mean, the way I phrase it is, he was checking out typewriter ribbons, you know, to see if they were being misused. He had no feel for what basketball was all about. So we started out my last season. Havlicek didn't go to training camp because of appendicitis. Dave Cowens, they had Cox back after taking a sabbatical. We didn't have Paul Silas. We started with the first eight games on the road. We signed Sidney Wicks like hours before the season started. So he never went to the training camp, right? So we got off to a horrible start. And politics, when things aren't going well, becomes horrendous. And I'm not a political person. You don't want me? See you later. I'll do something else. So when we got to that stage, I almost quit. But Red and Irv Levin, or I should say Irv Levin and Red, try to force me to quit so they could bail out of my contract because I had a couple of years left. And I was thinking about, because they were holding press conferences on the road right next to me. Oh, what are you going to do with Tommy Heinsohn? You know, they'd come to me and they'd be out in the West Coast and they'd say, well, Tommy, what's going on? You're going to, I said, hey, I don't know. I said, all I know is I got a ticket back to Boston, so don't bother me.
And the irony of the timing is 78 when they drafted Larry. I mean,
I went to scout Larry the summer before I got fired, and he was going to play in the World Games, and he was sick when I went down there. But everybody was raving about him, okay? And when he played in the scrimmage, it was supposed to be scrimmages on a weekend. It was horrendously warm down in Louisville, and he got totally dehydrated. So he was not doing well, but he did play in the game. He couldn't even catch the ball. So when I went back to Red, I said, Red, everybody who was here for the week saying that he's the best of the camp. I said, he couldn't prove it by me, because I told him how ill he was. And I said, but if Sidney Moncrief pops up, get Sidney Moncrief, okay? He can play. And so, you know, by then I was gone. And so I really didn't know what would happen. I televised Bird's first game, college game, that was televised for HBO. And Red was at that game. It was like the beginning of the season. And after like 5 minutes, I looked at Red, and Red looked at me and went, wow, we got to get this guy. You know, it was so obvious. No wonder everybody was talking about
it. Do you ever wish you could have coached Larry?
Hey, my time was there. You know, there's only so much emotion that you can engender. This thing is, coaching is a consuming thing. It consumes your energy. It consumes your passion. You know, guys hang in there for the money, and that never motivated me. I've been a lucky person. I've been able to do things that I truly love to do. And if, regardless of, you know, what the money is. And so certain guys, are, you know, they go through this agony. And as soon as it became super political, I didn't want any part of it. I was really, like I said before, thinking of quitting myself, but didn't do it. And I said to myself, if they're going to do this to me, I'm going to make them pay for the price, for the privilege.
And you almost took another job, right, in Houston. You were looking at that.
I was offered many jobs after I retired, as or asked to leave. And they called me up in Houston after I was broadcasting for a radio, on radio, the NBA playoffs. And so I was on the scene, and I guess Bill Fitch told me he recommended me to Ray Patterson, who was the general manager of Houston. And Fitch had been a friend of mine, and Patterson knew me because I was president of the Coaches Association and got a pension plan for the coaches from my insurance background. And so he knew me pretty well, and I knew him. But when I tried out a player that I would like to see them get if I was going to coach, and they looked at me like I was crazy, I said, man, this is, we're not even going to be close on the same page. You know, I'm going to be here 5 years and I'll be fighting with these people every day over this or that, you know. So besides, I would have had to take a pay cut to take the job. And that was a lot of money they were talking about.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out the MMQB podcast with Peter King.
ESPN is aware of my interest, and so they asked, hey, any interest in doing any sideline reporting for any NBA games? And I'm like, yes! Because as you know, Peter, when you get to do something outside your sphere of work, it's exciting.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Peter King wherever you download your shows.
Who was not necessarily the greatest Celtic you ever saw, but maybe your favorite Celtic, someone that you've had a great relationship with that dates back?
You know, players like Don Chaney. Who's Don Chaney, you would say now? You know, here's an integral part of our championship teams when I was coaching. Now, this guy, he was so focused on being a good player and a good teammate. After every game, he'd order, stop at the restaurant downstairs, buy something, take it up to his room, and go to sleep. And anything I asked him to do, I worked with him for almost 2 years teaching him how to shoot because he was throwing curveballs up there when he first showed up. And he worked darn hard at it. And then he got fairly decent at it, so that a couple of games he scored in the middle 20s. And then he started looking for his shot, okay? And we lost a couple of games. So finally I went up to him and I said, Don, let me ask you a question. How you feel right now? Oh, I feel great. You know, I said, Don, let me tell you this. Right now, we're losing. And I know you and I have worked so hard to develop your shooting. I said, but we got other people that can do this. We don't have other people to do what you can do best, which is defend people, rebound the ball, and get up and down the floor. And if a shot shows up, you take it. But we're not going, you know, going off one-on-one is not what we should be doing. So he looked at me and he said, you're right. Mm-hmm. And he went back and he did what he, I mean, that's quite a thing. So people like that, I had players like that. Dave Cowens, it was really, you had to try and control his eagerness, his ferocity. I mean, he was was considered by most to be a power forward. I made him a center, and he wanted to be a center. And it required a lot of changeover. He didn't really know how to shoot either when he showed up. And we worked on that many a game in the first year that he played. I'd be standing there yelling, shoot the ball, shoot the ball. And he'd come in at timeout and say, Tommy, I don't want to shoot the ball anymore. And I would say, Dave, listen to me. You have to learn to shoot the ball. The more you miss now, the sooner you're going to make them. So keep shooting, will you please? And that's how we developed them.
What was your relationship like with Bird as a broadcaster?
Oh, Bird, you don't intrude on Bird, all right? Bird has got his own, he's a suspicious person. You know, I would, and the same with KG when he was here. So, I'd nod to them, and when they play great, I go up and congratulate them and stuff like that. So, I mean, I never utilize my standing in the scheme of things to force myself on Bird. All right, Bird was such a gifted player. I mean, I coined it when he was playing. He's the Bobby Fischer of basketball. You know, he plays chess; everybody else plays checkers, and he's 3 moves ahead of you all the time. And he played the game with his head. He couldn't guard me now. Okay, in his heyday, he was the world's worst man-on-man defender. But, boy, he made the all-defensive team because he was like a middle linebacker. He broke plays up. He knew what they were all doing. Talk about competitors. Holy mackerel. I mean, just to motivate himself, he'd tell him what he was going to do. Never heard that one before. And then he'd do it.
Mikhail was the great defender on those teams, right?
Yeah, Maxwell. Maxwell was the first guy that covered it. You know, Maxwell got all the tough job of defending the best big man, you know, scorer other than a center. And then Mikhail was coming off the bench, and Mikhail took it from there, you know, as he became the sixth man, and then he became the starter after Maxwell left.
Of the coaches that you've interacted with, the Celtics coaches since, you know, early 80s being a broadcaster, who have you enjoyed the most?
Well, Doc was great. I had a relationship with Rick Pitino. I thought Rick Pitino, when he came, would be very good because I met Rick Pitino when he got his first college job at BU. And I followed his career, and we had lunch together walking down Newbury Street. One day he bumped into me, and he introduced himself. And so I went to a few of BU games, and then I followed him at Providence College. And when he got the Kentucky job, I was a part owner in a radio network that did UK games on radio. And the president of UK had just retired. He was on our board of directors. And he asked me, what kind of coach is Pitino going to be? I said, look, there are guys on your team that last year you thought shouldn't have been given a scholarship who will become stars of this team. I said, within 5 years, this guy will make them forget Adolph Rupp. So the next year, we have a board meeting, and he comes up to me and he says, Tommy, you were right, a buddy, about this guy. But when he got to the Celtics, he became a celebrity and a personality. I mean, he was getting $100,000 to go out and speak motivational things, you know. And he reached a point in his career where what he was doing wasn't working. And it had made him successful all the way along the line. And I told my wife at the time, he's either going to be smart enough to try and change, or he's going to say to himself, it's got me this far, I'll keep doing it. And that's what he did do, and it didn't work, and he went out the door.
You might be, I think probably are, the most famous local broadcaster in the NBA right now. Are you still enjoying it? Is it still?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, now the referees are talking to me. Like I say, Mike and I mean, this is, I'd be going to the games anyway.
Right.
You know, so Mike and I just, we've had so much fun over the years. I'm lucky that I got involved with Mike way back. Dave Gavitt put us together to do Providence College games. And when I was asked to do the color on the Celtic games by Prism, they asked me who I'd like to have as a play-by-play guy, and I said Mike. And I had worked with a lot of people, but Mike, I mean, it just flowed.
How many times do referees come up to you and just, you know, say, take it easy on me today? Or
no, they don't.
No.
They don't do that. But like Brothers.
Tony Brothers, yeah.
Yeah, Tony Brothers. There's a little fun he and I have. You know, Mike fosters this thing. And the other night at the game, everybody, you know, I normally don't talk to them, you know, because it was a funny story. I was down at the Hall of Fame, and there was a bunch of them at a table after the thing, and I'm sitting with my family, and I talked to one or two of them. The rest of them got up and walked away.
So they're listening. They're
Oh yeah, man! Come on. It's funny. But, you know, I took a lot of heat because of what I say. And, you know, everybody construed it to be I was trying to bail the Celtics out because of the referees. But I thoroughly believe that there's two basketball teams and there's a team of referees, and they all have an impact on the game. So when you talk about the players and they're not getting it done, this other team has to ante up and do the job too. And if they do the job, you never talk about them.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the direction of this Celtics team? Brad Stevens, Danny, youth movements, whatnot.
Oh, this is what you should be doing. You know, I mean, how many teams have you seen that have some players and then all of a sudden they start trying to get Band-Aids to patch it all together? Danny is developing, getting players that can be developed in his mind. And they look to be mostly very competitive people. And they got certain traits that I think are terrific. They're willing to be part of a team. And then Brad is the perfect coach because he knows how to bring players along. Now, Doc Rivers is a terrific coach, but he didn't bring players along, right? Brad is an ex-college coach who was into developing players in college over 4 years. So it's natural to him. So a lot of these players have grown, and I'm amazed at times when he plays certain guys. you know, and they may not make a total impact, but that's necessary for my own management experience to put them in there that you believe they can get the job done. Mm. That's the first thing a player has to learn is that I belong. Mm.
Well, Tommy, I grew up listening to you, and it's been a thrill to work with you in the past, this stuff. Thanks for taking some time to stop and do this.
My pleasure, Chris.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Tommy Heinsohn for joining the show. A reminder, you can download this podcast and other archive podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, really anywhere you can download podcasts. If you like it, post a comment, give us a rating. You know I appreciate it. While you're there, check out the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Woj. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.